Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Eric Weinberg gives the first in a series of talks based on the book Ultimately Perfect by His Eminence Taisitu Rinpoche, taking a look at Chapter 1, The Purpose of Life. So what is life anyway? Why we are here means looking back. What we are here for means looking forward. But the past is gone, and the future never arrives. We are always here, always now. How can we make this moment meaningful? If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So good morning, everybody. Welcome to all from near and far. I see some people from afar. Last week, we started out talking about the Indian masters that were kind of the fountainhead of this particular lineage of teachings. So we talked principally about Talopa and Aropa and a few other characters like Naguma and Sukhasiddhi, at least got a mention. And that the rest of the talks will be based really on a book called The History of the Karmapas. In that whole line of teaching. Then there's a second line, just to make it more confusing for everybody. We're using two books at the same time. So we're gonna go with a biography or two in 1 week, like last week. And then we're gonna be using this book, Ultimately Perfect, by His Eminence Taisitu. Because this is contains the essence of what these Indian masters and the early Tibetan masters and the Karmapas have taught. So we're going to mix it up. A little bit of biography, a little bit of what they taught, and then back to a little bit of biography and so on and so forth. In order just to make it so it's not a book report on biographies or just, you know, Dharma teaching straight up. Break it up so that you get an idea of who these human beings are and also the development of their thought process. Taisitu is very special to me. While I first learned to meditate in the mid-70s, it wasn't until the late 90s that I took refuge as a Buddhist. And the reason I took refuge as a Buddhist was I was walking down in the short north, back when it was mostly art galleries and things like that. And just taking a break from work. My shoes back then were very shiny. My throat was very tight because I had to wear a tie and so on and so forth. And I was walking by an old wooden telephone pole like we used to have. And stapled to it was a handbill and a picture of this guy. I don't know if there's a picture of him in here or not. Probably there is. I don't know. If not, it's worth going to look at him. He's got one of the greatest faces of all time. And it just galvanized me like that. And I looked and I saw that this guy's name was Taisitu and that he was given a public talk on Friday night at the Great Southern Hotel Ballroom. And I said, man, I got to meet this guy. I didn't know who this guy was. And I went to that, and literally, I did everything wrong. I was so, had such a big, let's call it an emotional upsurge, that I decided on the spot, I'm going to go to the Saturday teaching at Columbus KTC, and I'm going to take refuge, and this is it. So he became my refuge lama. He was the one, he was like the fisherman with the right hook and the right bait, I guess. And he hooked me. So to be able to teach from a book of his is pretty wonderful for me. He also happens to be the guru of the 17th Karmapa. He's literally a lineage holder. So when you look at a Karmakaju refuge tree, you'll see Situ Rinpoche's, you know, represented there, because they, along the lines, have been in charge of receiving the teachings from the Karmapa, and then when the Karmapa passes, holding the prediction letter of where to go find the next rebirth and then be their guru. So that's who this guy is. So it's cool, and it fits right into this concept we have of talking a little bit about the biographies of the Karmapas, and also, you know, what they've taught, or some of what they've taught. Unfortunately, I resonated with pretty much everything in this book. So as I went through to outline it a little bit and highlight it, I pretty much highlighted everything. And I'm going to try to actually make that kind of a preparation into something that's helpful to you. So please pray that this talk is of some benefit. So pray for that as we also go for refuge, as we always do when we start these kind of teachings, to kind of set up our motivation. If you know the prayer in Tibetan, please chant it along with me. If you don't, however, it's a simple prayer that we take refuge in the Buddha, which is enlightened mind. Buddha literally means awakened. The Dharma, which are the teachings, you know, kind of the light that fills the darkness. And the Sangha, which are all the beings in the past, present, and future that support the awakening of all beings without exception, including everybody here in this room. And that we do this for the benefit of ourselves and all beings without exception. Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Yi Pe Sunam Ki Drola Pen Shir Sanje Drupar Shok Sanje Chudong Soki Chok Nam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Su Chi Daki Jin So Yi Pe Sonam Gi Drola Pen Shir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudang So Ki Chok Nam La Jangchu Bardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki Jun So Ipe Sonam Ki Rola Penshir Sanjay Druparsho. Thank you. So he starts out, the first chapter is called The Purpose of Life. Like, why am I here? Am I here just to, like, stay alive? Am I here just to eat, to sleep, to talk, to walk, to breathe, and so on? Well, yeah. So actually, that is part of the purpose of life. But as Ron Popeil has always said, wait, there's more. If you open up today for only $19.95, we'll send you. Here's what we'll send you. Taisitu says that when we try to define why we're here, why means looking back. It's kind of a review. It's like, okay, I've done these things, I've experienced these things. This is what's been going on for me. And we try to get a hold on what that means. So then we also look at how our life is meaningful. And thinking about that, how it's meaningful and how it can be more meaningful, is about looking forward. There's a reason that everything that's happened has happened. And what we do right now has some like impact on what will happen in the future. So it's profoundly important and meaningful to think about these things, to get an idea of what's running us around. And he said, actually, we don't have any choice but to make this life meaningful and to make it purposeful. Even if we reject the whole notion of doing it, that actually itself has some meaning, and that actually itself has some purpose, and we will, no matter what, reap the benefits of what it is that we choose to do. And that's been going on since before this body was even here. He makes that point more strongly a little bit back in the chapter. The point, though, is that it's absolutely in our hands. And it's actually also our right. It's our right to have a meaningless life if that's what we want. It's okay. He compares life, the life stream, to be like the Ganges River, which in certain places is really, really rough and really fast and really full of waves and white water, and some places very still. Some places it's clean. A lot of places it's really dirty. Some places it's pleasant, and some places it's not. And he said, our lives are like that. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not the river anymore if it's not what we like. And that's a really important thing. He said, what has gone before, obviously, we have no control over. Sort of what's done is done. we can't do anything about it. He also said that just because you don't like it, you can't end your life. You can't. He goes right into the teeth of this and says, hey, there is no checking out. Here we are. It flows on, with or without this body. He said, some people think they can end their life by taking poison or by jumping off the 30th floor of a building, but that's not true. They end their body, but not their mind. What takes our body, a live body, is our mind living in it. It's an occupied house, and when that house becomes unlivable, then it becomes an unoccupied house. The person who's been living in that house is checked out. So when our body becomes such that it cannot sustain our mind, then our mind leaves our body. Our body is like a cage. Our mind is like a bird. So a bird in a cage. Some people like their cage. And some people don't like their cage. So this whole idea of Dharma is to get this thing. This kind of teaching at the beginning of this kind of book is what's called establishing the view. It's like how to look at it. And then the Dharma that goes along with it is to look at the relationship that this mind has with whatever view you actually have, because you might not have this view at this point. And by practicing the Dharma, obviously, we have an opportunity to change our relationship to what our impressions and experiences are. And when we change our relationship to see how things actually are, well, that's called a realization. It's called a realization. Maybe not complete enlightenment, even though I know I promised that in the first thing. I'm sorry, I lied. Or maybe not, who knows? Anything could happen. But for me, you know, I've been not expecting that for myself anyway, anytime soon. So he talks about this life as being beyond this form that we happen to like or we happen to not like in a given day. And at the end, if you do think you're the body, and most of us do, by the way, that's kind of built in, the mind checks out and they take the body and he talks about it, they put it in a nice little box and then they do things to it. It's a very nice box that they put in there, surrounded by flowers. They make sure the room is all peaceful and all that kind of stuff. He says, but the mind goes on, and it actually has an invisible body for a while. When our mind has this invisible body, all of a sudden, since it doesn't have a physical one, it can go through doors, it can go through walls, it can go through obstacles. It does not have a speed limit. It can be faster than the speed of light. It can be slower than a mountain. And it can be faster than the speed of light and slower than a mountain all at the same time. And he asks, are we alive at that time? He said, well, of course we're alive at that time. We're alive all the time. All the time. We are primordial. Our body can be dead, but our mind can be alive. Our body can be in any condition. I think that is the... he calls this book Ultimately Perfect because that's the ultimate view. I think for the great lamas who came through what we all would consider to be real torture when the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1959, and then endured even more in refugee camps for decades afterwards. Their bodies were alive, but actually their circumstances were really very difficult. For them, this is what, like a stinky part of the river, you know? They didn't feel like they had to do anything except to maintain their samaya and their practice. And know that, you know, this part of the river is unpleasant. There will be another part of the river. I know for Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, it's like that. I know that his experience in the refugee camp in Buxtor was horrifying. I know that this is weird, but he got tuberculosis there and cholera and a whole bunch of other stuff that was pretty serious and deadly. And I heard from another monk that he used to, even when he was as sick as he was, get up every day, put on his robes, even though by now they were very dirty and tattered and falling apart, and do his practice, the practice that he had a commitment to do. Obviously, that had to do with how he is today. It also had a lot to do with how a lot of other people are today, because others who were on the verge of giving up hope saw him and were inspired by him and didn't give up hope. I heard one monk tell me that this monk was in Buxtor too, so he didn't have like a big view like of Buddhism all over the world or Tibetan Buddhism all over the world. But he said, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche saved Tibetan Buddhism because of all those tens of thousands or thousands, whatever, were in there. He was the one that didn't give up hope, and he continued to do what he needed to do for his own practice. It's humbling to me because I can get thrown off by the politics of the day. Something simple like that. Yeah, it's a big hairy deal what goes on. Or I can get thrown off by a bad situation or a bad market or a bad fight with Jeannie or something like that and just, you know, blow up a day. And I think it's all that. It's not. The thing is just I don't have enough capacity to take that and digest it and turn it into the energy that I need to keep my commitments. And so therefore, what happens? Well, I recognize that at some point. And I realized that I've just created yet another obstacle for myself, which is really too bad. I don't need any more. Because that's how it goes with our choices, especially the ones that we think are so logical and make so much sense and are so justified. When we run away from what we know we ought to be doing, we create basically an obstacle. No big deal, it's just rocking the river. The river will go on. And for that, there's no retribution or anything. It's just a matter of, oh, now I have the opportunity to purify this obstacle, which just means going back to doing what it is that I've committed myself to do. So anyway, he'd advanced well beyond that point, apparently, by the time that he was in a refugee camp. And he was able to just digest that whole experience, as indigestible and difficult as it was, and allow it to bring more commitment and fire more magnetic energy for the benefit of others into it. And that lasted all the way till he got out, and it wasn't long after that that he got very sick. And I think he wanted to go into retreat for the rest of his life, which wouldn't have been very long in the opinion of the 16th Karmapa. And so the 16th Karmapa, seeing his ability to teach, said, "No, I want you to teach." And then he taught in monastery for a while, and then he was sent to America to found His Holiness Karmapa's seat in Woodstock, New York. The subtext of that, I haven't heard this from Kempo or anybody else, but the rumor I've heard is that Karmapa was also saving his life because he knew he'd get the medical attention he needed here to deal with the TB that he had. So now he's 95, right? If you have an opportunity and the inclination to go up and see him sometime in Woodstock, I know you've heard that before. Please do it. It's an important thing. And it gives you some living example or an idea of how all this works. Taisitu says in this chapter, you know, it's like, these things, how life unfolds is very, very much tied to what we do and how we do it and why we do it. And that's what this purpose of life thing gets underneath. And the purpose of life is to work out the causes and conditions that we've created in the past, because we are already the production of our own doing. We are not an accident. We're not a bolt from the blue. Each one of us is a masterpiece. Of all our actions and intentions of countless lifetimes of the past, each one of us is a masterpiece. Each one of those things is a stroke on the painting, if you will. So what we have here is, if you believe all that, if you take that view, you have some kind of responsibility to yourself to enhance the good things and to minimize the bad things. We obviously are hardwired. We have survival mechanisms built in that cause fundamental, what we call ignorance or self-grasping. Just fundamental. It's part of the evolution of the human body. It's just built in there. But we can work with that, and we can become conscious of that. We can begin to make choices without getting too crazy about it. People can go crazy trying to grasp at something besides who we are right now, this masterpiece that we are right now. You know, and that doesn't help, because that's still kind of being grabby. And then it causes more suffering, because obviously anything that we get in that fashion isn't sort of coming from our direct experience. It's coming from our desires and what we want. It's doomed to cause us some problems when we don't get what we want. Taisitu's advice is just improve 1% this lifetime, or maybe even 0.5%. He said in 100 or 200 lifetimes, you'll be a Buddha. That's nothing. That's nothing. So he's encouraging us to have the view and to understand, to be purposeful about what we do, and he's encouraging us to choose meaningful things to do with our time and energy and so on. Because it leads to ultimately our happiness and liberation. And that's his vow, is to actually support us in our journey towards happiness and liberation. He said, you don't know how you're going to come back. You could be Mr. Gupta or Mr. Armstrong or Mrs. Smith. You could also be a dog named Cujo or a cockroach. Anything can happen. But if we do our best to undo all the negative aspects of what we understand right now and purify all the negative aspects by using all the positive aspects and improve all the positive aspects, then we will improve from one life to another. And that's what he calls a meaningful life, is simply making the choices to improve from one life to another. So the purpose is to work with what we've got. And for that, we have to understand that what we've got, Guru Rinpoche, that one, said, if you want to understand your past lives, look at your present life. That's what he's talking about, because this is a perfect result of whatever that was. And if you want to understand your future lives, if you want to be a fortune teller, look at your present life. Because what you're doing right now is creating the causes and conditions for what happens next. So now I'm going to actually read you something, because he says this well. And he said, I will give you an example, which for me is the highest example, which is Buddha Shakyamuni. Because of all his countless past lives, good karma and everything, he was born Prince Siddhartha. He was not born Buddha Shakyamuni. So he was born as a prince, the bad aspect of which was that his father and mother and everybody wanted him to become the most powerful king. They meant well. You cannot find anybody who cares about you more than your mother and your father. Sometimes they care for you more than you care for yourself. That is what they call mother's worry. All mothers worry about their children, because they care too much and it becomes more than children care for themselves. Anyway, it was a good thing for his father and mother to want him to be the king, because he was already a prince, and they also wanted him to be a very big king. He was already kind of a medium king, his dad was. He was growing the family fortune, you know. That was the goal. Taisitu said, I think today there aren't that many kingdoms, but there are many countries, and they want the same thing. So that was the negative aspect of Prince Siddhartha's life. They didn't want him to really have to do anything to get anything. That was the negative aspect. His parents didn't want him to have to do anything to get anything, because he was born to a very, very important family, and they just wanted it to grow more and more. For him, every aspect of his life that was unpleasant was hidden from him. He was just one person. He had only two eyes, two ears, two legs, two hands, just like all of us. He could not be everywhere. So wherever he went, he was made to feel like things were perfect. Also, whoever was going to be around him was made perfect. They literally did put makeup on people so they didn't look so old and sick and tired and so on. Some stories say they put masks on everybody so that he couldn't see. Therefore, he had no real idea of what was going on. His mother died young, but his father didn't want him to see anything that was unpleasant, so that was negative. But negative becomes positive if you have good karma, because your good karma is more powerful. If your good karma is 100 kilos and your bad karma is only 5, then 100 kilos will be very heavy and 5 kilos will be tossed around like nothing. So that's what happened. He wanted to see what was out there. That was his good karma taking over. He wanted to know how it was. When we look, when we stop the momentum of our just the treadmill of our lives and we become aware, even if what we become aware of is difficult, that's good. And it became an important factor in motivating his life. He came to see birth, old age, sickness, and death on his journeys outside the palace. Siddhartha asked his faithful driver, his chariot driver, sincere questions about what he saw. He said, "What is that?" And the chariot driver said, "That's a sick person." "Can I be sick?" Driver said, "Yeah, of course. Of course you will be sick." Then he saw somebody who was dead, carried away by people while others were crying and some playing music. And Siddhartha asked the chariot driver, "What is this?" And the driver said, "Somebody is dead." And he asked, "Will I die?" And he said, "Of course you will die. One day you will die." Until then, he didn't know he would get sick or that he would die. The reason he didn't was when he was born, they had like some powerful priests and astrologers come in. And these guys said, "Oh, this kid's got a lot of gifts. Stars are all aligned. He could be a really big king, or he could be an enlightened being if he renounces everything." And that's why they were just trying to like make sure the kid took their own agenda. Well, we know what happened next. At a certain point, he just decided he didn't need to be the biggest king. And he thought, that would be quite neurotic, actually, because I can't avoid sickness and death. What would be a useful and meaningful purpose of my life would be to actually figure out the meaning of all this suffering and how to work with it. In fact, how to destroy the suffering. That would be bigger than being the biggest king. That's still actually true to this day. Each of us in our own little way have that tension between being the biggest king that we can be in whatever we're doing, or working on this connection that we have to the way things are and finding a way to change it so that it's no longer a connection that produces the causes and conditions for suffering for ourselves and others. That's what it is. Siddhartha got it. He got it because Taisitu says, because for trillions of eons ago, he had made the Bodhisattva aspiration to benefit beings. So after trillions of eons of revisiting that in many, many lifetimes, his bodhisattva karma just outweighed his princely karma. And as he says, it kind of tossed it around. It would be easy to think that our purpose here is to become a Buddha in this lifetime. Taisitu said, I wouldn't say that because it's up to each individual. We each get to decide. You can choose to be the best designer, the best writer, the best architect, the happy yogi, or you can choose to be a worldly being, living a practical life, and practicing Dharma on the side. So whatever you choose, whatever you achieve will be according to that. You will not achieve something unless you wish to achieve it. There is no accidental enlightenment. Damn. You just can't be enlightened by a mistake. There's no, as he says, oops, I'm enlightened. It doesn't happen that way. Everything's cause and result. Except the final enlightenment, which actually transcends that. So how does that work? There's this teaching called the 12 links of interdependent origination. Have you ever heard that? Has anybody heard of that thing before? Yeah, one thing, you know, it's kind of like the vicious cycle of samsara. You ever see those mandalas with the guy with the big claws and fangs holding the wheel, and there's like these three animals in the middle, and there's six realms around the side? That's kind of a picture of what we've labeled samsara. And as long as we're in that picture, all we can do is to work to wear away at what causes that picture to be the picture of our lives. It's like a self-portrait. It's like holding up a mirror. If the mirror is reflecting not just this life and what you look like today, but this life and all, every past life forever and ever. I actually wrote something about that when I was reading this. I'm going to read it. It's dense, but it doesn't matter because this is what this material inspired. So how do you get into that wheel? I mean, that was my question. If I'm going to make this meaningful and purposeful, I'd probably figure, okay, how do I get into this mess in the first place? At some moment, long before anything I can remember, the groundless infinity of mind's nature, limitless, luminous awareness freaked out. It freaked out consciousness because it didn't think it could handle it. It's just too big, too bright, too intense. And then consciousness, being aware of awareness, reacts to its overwhelmment, trying to get its ground by grasping at experiencer and experience as a personal self. I, me, and mine, and everything else as other. All of it seems solid and dependable and inherently existing. The way the personal self-identity appears depends on a whole string of causes, conditions, and energies, arising from the accumulations of eons of habitual reactions. Some call it karma. This energy is expressed as habitual traits and preferences, which are mistakenly taken to be objective truth. Personal experiences become crystallized as experiences of other or that, and are labeled as desirable, undesirable, and neutral. These three are the building blocks of basic ignorance, which is the perfect growth matrix for a flourishing crop of mental poisons, which in turn propel the cycle. Each grasping forms a new impression, deepening and empowering habitual traits, and that crystallizes what we call a self. The process seems to have its own internal logic. Self-cherishing seems justified, which only adds power to the cycle and increases our suffering. When these seemingly solid, powerful, true self-created things fall apart, it hurts. Most definitions of samsara sum up this cycle well. Ignorance traps us in a pattern that perpetuates and strengthens our unfreedom and suffering. Dharma is the path, the process, by which we can dissolve the darkness of ignorance, harmonize energies, purify impurities, and break the chains of the cycle in which we have imprisoned ourselves, revealing the door to freedom and sanity. In the hands of a master and a devoted student, Dharma can bring about a direct experience of breaking chains, of letting go, unclenching, opening our fists, and seeing things as they are. The emptiness we've been holding so tight to in the palm of our hands, it's like this and like that. What's there? And with that arises the confidence that everything we need is all here, all now. There is limitless, luminous space for it. The illusion of "I am not that" dissolves, and the brightness of "I am that" dawns. Fear dissolves into love, anger into patience, jealousy into all-accomplishing wisdom, pride into equanimity, and desire into discriminating wisdom. Awareness conditioned by mental poisons is samsara. Awareness free of mental poisons is nirvana. Therefore, the preciousness of your teacher who has the antidote to the poison cannot be overstated, and the importance of making a profound commitment to diligently practice what your teacher has given you as your practice is the point on which your progress on the path hinges. Practice properly and the door opens, and you no longer experience yourself as a thing among things. You realize you are a luminous open space for things, actions, and qualities, and you always were. Or don't, and it won't. So there's this exercise. Point at something in front of you. Just do it. Point at it. So you can see shapes, colors, so on and so forth. So point to your foot. You see your foot. And you point to your knee. You can see your knee. You point to your chest. all your attention is directed outward to objects, that even without just a moment to consider, to reflect, any spacious awareness, you regard them as that. Now point to your face. What do you see? Seriously, ask yourself, what do I see? You are now looking inward, turning your attention around 180 degrees. While there are objects out there, what do you see when you're pointing just that close to your own face? Do you see your face? Do you see anything at all? Any color? Any shape? Any movement? Looking at this place where other people see face, you see. Nothing. Actually, it's not nothing, obviously. But it is empty of all those characteristics. It is clear, transparent. It's got the boundless capacity to contain everything, everything. And it's awake and it's aware. So this capacity is full of everything, everything happening. Everything, even beyond the sound of my voice and my feelings and my thoughts, all that appears and exists for me, there it is. So you can put your finger down. It's just a little thought experiment. That's not really anything, even a meditation. It's a thought experiment to try to actually catch a glimpse of how you are actually ultimately beyond that wheel called samsara, and yet your awareness is still your awareness. Awareness bound by these afflictive emotions is samsara. Awareness unbound by afflictive emotions is nirvana. Nirvana infused with bodhicitta, or compassion, is Buddhahood, is enlightenment. So the purpose of life, which is the title of the book, is to recognize the actions of all these afflictive emotions and realize that they're just the thought that's passing through. They're just some stinky water flowing down the river. But it's not you. It appears You are actually ultimately perfect. You are ultimately perfect. You always were. You always will be. We just don't recognize it. So that's way more than enough for now. That's why the title of the book is Ultimately Perfect. It gets a little bit, I can tell this room went like, whoa. But it's like that. It's really worthwhile to consider these teachings deeply, not just as a magic bullet for what bugs you today, but actually to take on the view of what bugs you or doesn't bug you today as a path to liberation. So that's enough. I preached enough. There are a few minutes left for questions. I'm sure I confused the heck out of everybody. Comments, anything you got. So please feel free to.
Thanks for your teaching. Yeah, when you were talking about pointing to different parts of your body, I was thinking it's like a hand signal. And it's weird that dogs have a natural aptitude to, once they get to know you, you point at things and they look at things.
Yeah.
And I heard, now I've never had a chimpanzee as a pet, but I've heard that chimpanzees don't have that aptitude, that not naturally. You point to something, they'll just look at you.
Really? Yeah.
And you have to teach them through trial and error and rewards and stuff like that, and then they get the aptitude. I mean, they can learn sign language, but that just, I mean, when I was looking at my finger, the first thing I thought of was, here's a person with PTS, and then I think, all money pay me home, and then I see the emptiness.
See, that's perfect. So you applied Dharma to this label.
Yeah, that's just me.
Yeah, I love that story. There's another little exercise you can do as you walk around and you look at whatever you look at or experience whatever you experience. Obviously, the first thing that we do is we label it, we try to understand it, we try to master it. That's sort of what we do. That's a way of becoming an even bigger king. You know, if you think about it, I've been thinking about this. When I'm critical of somebody or something, I'm demonstrating my understanding and my mastery and how I'm in some way better than. That's like Prince Siddhartha becoming the bigger king instead of becoming a Buddha. On the other hand, if you do this other thing, and I have very, very strong tendency to try to figure things out and label them and master them. That's sort of something I do. On the other hand, if I recognize that that's the quality of my attention at that moment, and I just turn it around and I have, say, a mantra, like a compassion mantra, or I can make a declaration and say, I am that. So when I look at you, rather than thinking of it as you, I realize that you actually are present in a very real way in my awareness. I contain the experience of you. You are a part of me. It changes the whole game. Compassion easily arises for whatever it is that I encounter when I recognize that it's a part of me. Why would I want to hate or be angry at a part of myself? If it's not good, if it's a stinky, awful part of myself, I might want to do the hard work of transforming it or changing it or improving it. But I'm not going to have to want to hurt it or be angry with it or get it away from me in some way. Because frankly, I don't know. Maybe we can't. I feel like one of the things the Buddha taught was that everything is workable. Maybe not right now because we don't necessarily have the tools and the wisdom, but we can acquire tools and wisdom, and that's what having the Dharma in our lives is all about. It's to give us what we need to create the causes and conditions to work with anything that appears and exists with compassion and with loving kindness. I think that's bottom line, but I'm not sure. So, I mean, I feel like I dropped a water balloon on the room. Well, I hope that in some ways was beneficial. And in any case, let's dedicate the merit of having gathered together for the purpose of understanding our purpose and the meaningfulness of this moment and every moment, with the wish that all beings can come to the open, spacious awareness that causes kindness and compassion to dawn. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.